Welcome to the Project Happy Place podcast. I started this podcast to spark conversation and inspire people to do more of what makes them happy. I met my next guest a few years ago and immediately noticed he leads from the heart. After getting to know him more over the past few years, that initial realization is only further validated. But I didn't quite know why. Pete Erickson is the founder of Moda. He's based in Arlington, Virginia, with his wife, two kids, and dog. He's a community builder, force to be reckoned with in the voice space, and a recent Webby Award winner. But that all pales in comparison to Pete's ability to listen to his heart and make big shifts in his life in order to be in his happy place. And when I mentioned previously that I didn't know why he leads from his heart, well, that's just what we're going to cover today. We'll discuss some tough topics, including codependency and suicide. We are not licensed professionals, so please seek out additional support should these topics resonate with you.
The best way for others to learn is to hear other people's stories. So without further ado, I want to welcome to the Project Happy Place podcast, Pete Erickson.
Great to be here, Jane, and I really commend you on starting this. I have known you for a few years, and I've known about your journey, and I'm just thrilled to be here and to be a part of the Happy Place podcast.
Thank you. So I want to take people kind of back to the beginning, and when I mean the beginning, I'm talking we go way back to when you were in your family growing up. You're one of 10 children, and it's interesting because I sometimes think there's a disconnect for us. We don't realize like how we're raised can then translate into the type of adult that we become and the type of business leader that we might become. So right. If you can kind of touch a little bit about your upbringing for our guests and how that has kind of translated into you as, you know, a business leader.
Yeah, no, certainly. Yeah. So I grew up in a large Catholic family. I had four brothers and five sisters, and I was number five. My mom had, I think, five kids in like 6 years. So they started off very, very, very hot on having the kids. And, you know, my dad was, when I was born, my dad was actually a spy in the Navy, and my mom was a nurse. And I was actually born in Japan, of all things. So right after I was born, though, my dad went to work for United Airlines. We moved to California, sunny California, and lived in the South Bay. And my parents would go on to have, you know, four more children. And so we had nine kids. Then we moved up to Washington State from California, about an hour outside of Seattle. Had 5 acres and a barn and, you know, pigs and cows, and my parents thought that would be great for us, which it really was. And then, you know, we didn't have enough children, so my parents adopted one. So we adopted a boy from Medellin, Colombia, from an orphanage when he was 8 years old. His name is now John Robert Erickson, but he was parachuted into our family right in the middle of the big, what I call the big Catholic mess. But certainly grew up in a big family, in a house with, you know, always a lot of activity. And, you know, people loved coming over to the Erickson's house because there was always, you know, there was always a lot to do. There was always somebody to play with. And there was always ice cream in the freezer.
Nice. So you grew up in a large family, kind of in the middle. You then moved to Washington, D.C., I believe, in 2009.
Yep.
You got to DC. Can you tell the listeners a little bit more about what your career was, kind of what industry you were in at that time, and how you kind of started your life in DC?
Yeah. Take it quickly back. So in college, I'd started as a computer science major. I learned a program when I was in my teens on the Apple II. I went to college for computer science, but I discovered after 3 years I was not a great computer science student. And I really admired the fact that the business school students had Fridays off, and changed my degree to business administration with an emphasis in marketing. So I left college with sort of this kind of, you know, dual technology and business and marketing hat. And that sort of became the, you know, that was the playbook for me, is I really kind of combined those two things and, you know, went through the technology, you know, what's called the dot-com bubble back in the late 90s through 2001, 2002. Joined another startup that I was in for about 5 years, and then found myself in moving from Seattle to Washington, D.C. to marry my now wife, Sabrina. And that's worked out pretty well. 11 years and two kids, two healthy kids later. Things are going well. But I found myself in this new town. The iPhone had just come out. And you could see that the market was going to change. And I really wanted to collaborate with others in this new city I was in. And I was looking for where the kind of the tech hub was, and I couldn't really find out where everybody was hanging out. So I started a user community called Modev using meetup.com. And that was a great idea, because what started with, you know, 12 people in a pizza shop in Arlington on January 21st, 2009, turned into a monthly meetup that grew and grew and grew. And then I put a conference on in 2011. And then that really became my full-time job. I realized that, you know, convening people for a living was really worthwhile. And just the testimonials that people would give me from just from the monthly meetups and then the conferences, and people say, this is fabulous. Please keep going, keep going. And so I made it a business. So here I was in a new city with a new bride, starting a new family and a new business called Modev.
Yeah. And what I think is interesting, especially at this point in your story, is that you were kind of thrust into this where you wanted to start this organic community to start to meet over this new technology that you saw. There was a need. It grew over time. I think you said after the first year, in, when we've spoken previously, that there were almost 1,000 people. So you go from 12 people at a pizza shop to nearly 1,000. So there's obviously a demand there. You're creating community. People are networking. Then you decide, hey, this could be a business. I could start some conferences and run them. And then now you're a business owner, yeah, maybe wearing a hat that you didn't necessarily envision you would have. So what then kind of happened as your business grows? Are there any kind of commonalities or traits that you saw start to come to surface
based on your kind of upbringing? All my challenging traits came to the surface, but the good ones too. So the fact is, you know, I'd always kind of been a natural convener. You know, when I was living in Seattle, I started a co-rec soccer team that's kind of legendary. A lot of marriages started from this team, and these people are friends for life now. And I've got so many friends from that experience. I started a very popular party. So I had been convening before, and that part really came naturally. The part that was more challenging for me is the act of being an entrepreneur and running a business for a number of reasons. One, I didn't ever fully believe that I deserved it, which is, sounds kind of crazy, but like I worked for other people and I worked my butt off for other people. I would give and give and give till it hurt. And in the startup that I was with for, you know, 5 or 6 years before I moved to DC, you know, I gave way, way, way more than I needed to be giving to somebody else's company. But I had to get used to the idea with building my own thing and owning my own business and being successful in that. So that was a challenge for me to get over, is just to be able to accept that. The other major challenge that I had was I had a terrible affliction with codependency. And that just started to really kind of come to the top. And what I mean by that, so I'll share with your listeners a little bit about what that looks like. When you're a codependent leader, you are going to get into employment relationships where you are hiring people, whether they're just contractors or employees, where you're more concerned with their well-being than you are your company's well-being. And so you're going to set things up so that you're making sure that they're okay, but you're not fully making sure that your business is going to be okay. And so I found myself making a lot of hires where it gets very time consuming, because you're really working to try to like make these other people successful so that your company could then be successful. But the fallacy is in the codependent thinking is you're you think you're doing something right and something good, but you're actually doing something detrimental. And so that's, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I know I told, I guess I started the podcast by saying we were going to hit on some heavy hitting topics, and codependency is definitely one of them. And I was doing some work with Jessica Rector, who was on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and she had recommended I read a book, Codependent No More. And I pick up this book thinking, ah, ha, ha, it's going to be about all these other people. And I'm a couple pages into the book, just like, oh no. I was like, right. Wait, it was kind of a light bulb moment for me where thinking, oh yeah, maybe I am codependent. But I think we pick up these traits sometimes based on what we learn growing up through childhood and the behavior that we may see. And what you said makes a lot of sense. I think codependent people make really good employees too, because they're more concerned with the company they work for than themselves.
Oh yeah.
They then bend over backwards for these institutions rather than looking out for themselves. So I don't know if there's anything that
It's a brilliant observation. And it is so true. It is people can just give and give and give and give. And you know, there's goodness in giving, but I think that there's also the harm that you can do to yourself and do to your company. And as an entrepreneur, when you know, when you're trying to grow a company, you've got to make all the bills and do all that stuff, it starts to get, you know, it can get really challenging. So I definitely had my challenging years, and yes, I've done my work, and I know I can look back on my childhood. My parents were both from alcoholic homes. My mother was from a terribly alcoholic home. Her mother died at the age of 55 of congestive heart failure, but it was really driven by alcoholism. So there was a lot of pain that she carried forward. And I think that she wanted to create this big, beautiful, you know, family and this world that, you know, just had all this love you know, it came at a big expense in many different ways that we won't fully get into today, but just know that, you know, bringing an adoptive brother into the middle of a family that's 8 years old, that is really challenging for the children that are there. It's funny, I was aware of my challenges with codependency early on in the company, because it was, but I did not have the tools. And I hadn't gone through, I don't think enough pain to really have to deal with it. And I had another, you know, codependent situation with a younger brother who was an alcoholic, who, you know, was going through all of the challenges that alcoholics will go through in their lives, right? Loss of jobs, broken marriage, and just that constant, you know, trying to outwit or outsmart it so that you could get the next job. It was always this, if you could just get this next thing, right? So I hired him a couple times in my, you know, in my years at Modev to do different things for me. Of course, it just never could work out fully because he couldn't fully get there. But I learned, that was when my codependency. So I'll go to the end of 2015. So Christmas 2015, we had an intervention with him. He was living on a sister's couch in California. I was living of course, in Arlington, DC area. I found an interventionist. I found a treatment facility. I raised the money for the treatment facility and the interventionist. Flew out to California, had an intervention with him. He did great in the intervention. He and I flew to Seattle. I dropped him off, and he went through the treatment process. But what I also started that month was I started going to a group called Al-Anon, and Al-Anon's a little like your book. So a lot of people show up to their first Al-Anon meeting and they think they're going to hear about how they can fix the alcoholic. What are all your strategies for how do you do this right? Right. There's gotta be a playbook, right? There's gotta be some way to get, you know, but you know, what you find out at that first meeting is that you're not there for the alcoholic. You're there because of the alcoholic. You are there for yourself, and you are there to really heal yourself and of that codependent grip, that alcoholism can give us. And, so I really started, and after I really started the process of trying to understand codependency. And it, you know, and the terrible, sad reality of this whole experience with my brother is that he did great coming out of treatment and got a great job and things were looking really good, but alcoholism will creep its way back into your life. And it did with him. And 2 years later, he died by suicide. And it was, you know, it was just like, it was like a slow train wreck for those 2 years. But when he died, I had done so much work on my codependent relationship with him, but I had not really done the work about myself and codependency overall, and like all of the other ways and in my life where it was really having an impact. So I had really focused on my relationship with him. But just the shock and the trauma of that experience, that shone this huge light. It was like all of a sudden I was exposed, like, oh my God, here I am in my world of codependency. So there I was.
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, thank you for sharing your story about your brother, especially because I know that you have shared that with me, and it takes a lot of courage and vulnerability to be able to share that with other people. But I think that, you know, to get to where you are now in 2021 with the success of your business and the type of leader that you try to be every day, I think that this is just part of that story. And it's important to be able to tell it because it can then potentially resonate with other people that are going through something similar.
Thanks, Jane. I think, go ahead. You have another question?
Well, more so, Justin, you know, I think, you know, this being Project Happy Place podcast, people are going to think it's all sunshine and rainbows on the way there, but it really is not. and it is a lot of work. And if you can kind of, you know, take us back to that moment and where you kind of are now and how that has shaped your journey, because I know in talking with you, it is something that gets easier to sense potentially, but you've had to do a lot of work along the way for it to get to this point.
Well, let me tell you this. I want to, you know, today I'm happier than I've ever been in my life. And there's a paradox between saying, having that feeling and being in that place and knowing that, you know, I lost my brother. You know, and I wasn't able to save him. So what I had to do in the days, so there are things I did in the days following, right? And there are things I did in the weeks and the months, right? But like when he died, I realized alcohol was not important to me anymore. Like I felt like I could just let it go. And so I let alcohol go out of my life. And that was a huge decision. And I was not a heavy drinker. I think in my earlier in my life, in my 20s and 30s, I, like a lot of kids, would go out to the bars and drink too much. But, you know, after having a family and kind of like getting into a healthier relationship with alcohol, but also going through the, you know, the trials and tribulations with an alcoholic brother, there were times I stopped for months at a time, you know, and really trying to be in solidarity with the situation. But after he died, it was just like, it just did not, I just felt like, okay, now's the time to let that go. So I also knew that by letting alcohol go, I'd have to feel everything. I couldn't like mask it. I'd have to face the pain of that loss. And, but the other thing I did is Tim and I used to play music together. I'd always dinked around on the guitar. I played in bands like when I was in high school, but then I just, you know, went off to college and I never really pursued a music career after that. But Tim and I, when we got together, we would play and we'd play funny songs. And, but again, I never really took it seriously, never thought about, you know, really tuning my voice, but I decided to, you know, throw myself into music. I started playing every night. So after the kids would go to bed, I would come downstairs and I would just start playing and I'd start recording myself to understand what my voice sounds like. And then my wife got me voice lessons for Christmas that year. And that was a wonderful thing because I worked with a voice coach for, you know, for months, in one-on-one voice coaching and got my fingers strong on the guitar. And here I am, you know, 3 years later, having not drank for 3 years, 3 years of practicing and playing music almost every day. And now I play in a band. I can play hundreds and hundreds of songs. I'm writing. I took a writer's workshop this year. And through this process, continued to work, to attend my Al-Anon meetings and work on my codependency and really work on it, like all throughout all facets of my life. And suddenly I'm at this place 3 years later where my company is healthy. We made it through the pandemic. We got through because we could react and we could respond because I was clear of mind and I was confident and I didn't have those codependent relationships around me to sort of sink things. Although definitely was still shedding some of those relationships because I don't think you ever fully heal from something like that. You've always got to stay vigilant. But here I am, Jane, and it's like I am at a place where I am, you know, in a happy place. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the happy place, but I'm on this journey and I feel full and I feel whole as a person. And I feel like I can start to share my story to help others.
Thank you, Pete, for sharing. I honor your vulnerability and hope this story will resonate with others. Pete recently posted on LinkedIn to honor the 3-year anniversary of his brother's suicide. He wrote, "Today marks the 3-year anniversary of my younger brother, Tim's passing by suicide. I'm in a good place now, and I got here through making big changes in my life. I thought I would share my personal journey and some perspective and encourage you to pursue anything that might be holding you back. I am a better leader through the changes I've made, which have little to do with business. But if we're healthy and pursuing our passions, we can lead more effectively." His article is titled "Surviving Suicide Loss and Finding Joy" and is posted on medium.com. It's been read by over 500 people, and I know that it has resonated with many as they have reached out to him directly and thanked him for sharing his story. I appreciate you tuning in, and I hope you will rate and subscribe the podcast to get notified when new episodes are released. I truly appreciate you being here. Thank you.